Amen. Good morning, great men and women of God. I call you that for two reasons. One is because we say it every single Sunday to remind you of what Christ has done for you. But the second reason, more importantly this morning, is because you have no idea the amazing things that God can do through you to change this world. You have no idea. You have no idea the way that your personality, the way that your gifts, your strengths, your weaknesses, your unique wiring, the way that God has made you and only you, you have no idea the way that, paired with the Holy Spirit, can make this world a different place. No idea. God's uniquely wired you to play a role in restoring this world. And because of that, I call you great men and women of God, because that's pretty good. The proof of it is this reality that all of us live with, that somewhere in our hearts, there's something in us that just is frustrated with the way this world is. It's just not content with the things that we see out there, that maybe gets outraged or annoyed or just feels frustrated at the way the world is. And that thing in our hearts that all of us have is something that God put there, and it's an invitation for us to get in the game, to play a role in what God is doing to restore this place and to make this world what it should be. And that's why you're a great man or a great woman of God. Now, if you remember last week, we started a series, and we called it World Hack. That was the name of the series. And the idea for this series is it's all about how do we step into that invitation, how do we join with God to change the world. And the concept of World Hack comes from this concept of life hacks. And I'm sure some of you are familiar with life hacks. It's just these simple shortcuts that you and I can do to somehow make something that we're doing in our life a little bit easier, a little bit more accessible. And when we see it, we're like, oh, that's so obvious. I should have been doing that the whole time. Life hacks are stuff like this. This is a life hack. We all know how annoying it is to have to listen to music on our iPhone, and when we don't have speakers, but if you cut a little slit in some toilet paper roll and put your iPhone in there with some cups, apparently it makes the sound loud, and you can hear it, finally, without a speaker. Or you could just get an Android phone, because they're better, but if you're an iPhone user, for what it's worth, there's a life hack. But that's what life hacks are. They're like simple ways of doing something that we all need to do, and it's a shortcut. And the premise for the series is, I think, when we look at the world and we see what there is that needs to change, I think this, what we really need is a world hack. We need some way for you and I to engage with the world so that we can actually change it. Because if you haven't noticed this, the world is kind of unwieldy and it's slow to change and it's hard to make things different here on this place. We need a world hack. And last week we started looking at the life of Jesus, who obviously no one has changed the world more than Jesus. And I think it's because he had the ultimate life hack for the world. He had this thing that was so simple and it was so obvious, and he applied it in every situation, and it amounted to a huge change in the world because of Jesus. And if we want to change the world, we've got to get aligned with that thing, that simple world hack that Jesus knew we can know, and we can apply it in our life, and slowly things will begin to change in our world. Wouldn't that be great? But remember, last week I said this, we have to have the same foundation as Jesus when we try to change the world, or else we're going to do enormous damage. And we all have situations and examples of people that we've seen who really cared about the world being a different place, but because they were not in any way aligned with Jesus, they wound up hurting people and actually making the world worse off. And so last week we spent most of the time talking about those the first foundation, and it's this, that the gospel has to be first. That for Jesus, the gospel was above everything. That was the thing that he focused on. And we talked about this reality that you and I can draw attention to people's sin and brokenness, or we can draw attention to a God who does not condemn. But we can't do both. And if we're going to change the world in the way that Jesus changed the world, the gospel has to come first. And then I was about to tell you what the world hack was, and we ran out of time. And some of you were very upset with me. Somebody cornered me and they're like, I am moving this week. and they made me tell them, and I told them. I'm going to tell you what the world hack is. I'm just not going to tell you today what the world hack is. I'm going to tell you next week, and there's a very important reason that I'm not going to tell you today. It's because I think this truth means that we really have to make sure that we're aligned with the foundation that Jesus had. And not only was the gospel first, I think there was another foundational issue in Jesus' ministry that we have to have. We have to be on the same page with him. Here's the other foundational issue. We have to love actual people. That's like as simple as it gets, right? We have to love actual people. I know that's simple, but is this not the easiest thing to overlook and one of the hardest things to do ever? I don't know about you. I think it is so much easier to love ideas or to love concepts or to love the truth or to love ministry or to love the church or to love the Bible. Man, the Bible's way easier to love than actual people. And there's so many things that it is easier for us to love than actual people. But we have to realize we have never been called to love things. We've been called to love people. Actual, real, messy people. And that is a lot more difficult. But I think this is true. Just like we looked at last week, if we skip over this, if we skip over the loving of actual, real people, and we try to change this world, we're going to really hurt people. And we're going to do some enormous damage. And so we have to be clear on this foundation that Jesus had. He always loved actual people. I want to look at one story. If you have a Bible, turn to John 4. It's one of my favorite stories of Jesus. We're going to start in verse 5. And I want you to see in the story, there's a lot going on here, but I want you to see the foundation of how he loves an actual real person, and actually a handful of people too. John 4, verse 5, it says, "So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, 'Will you give me a drink?' His disciples had gone into the town to buy food." Now, to really understand the story and to really understand what we're about to read here and how remarkable it is, we have to understand what a Samaritan is. A Samaritan is someone from an area called Samaria, obviously. It's a region in the province of Judea. Now, hundreds of years before this moment, hundreds of years before Jesus shows up on the scene, the nation of Israel had split into actually two separate nations. And there was a northern kingdom and there was a southern kingdom, and Samaria was a city, the capital city of the northern kingdom. Now, the northern kingdom was kind of, they're the bad guys in most of the Old Testament, and they do a lot of really horrible stuff, and they were led by these incredibly wicked kings. And if you know your Old Testament at all, probably the most wicked of all of these kings is a king named Ahab. Now, Samaria was founded by Ahab's father, King Omri. And the reason he founded it is because when the kingdom split into two, he realized that the capital city, Jerusalem, and also the spiritual capital, the place where everybody went to worship, was in the southern kingdom. So he needed a new capital, and he needed a new place for all of his people to worship. And so he buys this mountain or this hill, and he builds a city on it called Samaria, and that's where Jesus was. He established a new center of worship on this hill, and he told all of his people, this is actually the place to worship, and he introduced all of these kind of wicked ways of worshiping God and other idols and pagan rites of worship and all this sort of stuff into the Jewish religion, and in a sense, he started his own cult based loosely on the Jewish religion. So that's King Omri. A few years after that, a few hundred years after that, the nation of Assyria invades the northern kingdom. And one of the things that they would do, the Assyrians, when they'd invade a kingdom and they wanted to keep it subdued, is they'd take a bunch of their men and they'd send them in to marry the local women and to have children. And that's what they did. And so the Samaritans were the offspring of these men who came in from Assyria and married all of these local women. And with that, they brought all of their pagan gods, all of their pagan rites of worship, and brought some really wicked stuff into this area of the world. And so that's where Jesus is. 700 years later, he's talking to a Samaritan who is a descendant of these like wicked Israelites who started their own cults, who were invaded by another country, intermarried with them, and introduced all of these other worship practices that were really wicked and awful and horrible. That's who Jesus is talking to. You may have heard this through the years that Jewish people didn't like Samaritans. I've always known that. I always thought it was just because they weren't ethnically pure. They worshipped in a different place. I thought they were kind of being a little racist. That's not it at all. Samaritans were like really bad people. They did really bad stuff. And what they're known for now is probably more than anything else the story of the Good Samaritan, right? You're familiar with that story. Well, part of what made that story remarkable was there was not a lot of Good Samaritans. They were not wonderful people. So Jesus is sitting at this well outside of this capital city that wicked King Omri built, and up walks this woman who worships very differently than him, and she's getting some water from the well, and he says, "Hey, can you give me a drink?" Look at what she says. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." That's kind of the understatement of the year. These people were polarly opposite. And I don't know if you catch this in her comment, but there's a little bit of pushback, a little bit of sarcasm in her reply. "You're going to ask someone like me for a drink?" Well, she grew up in this context, and so she knew all of this stuff. And she looks at this Jewish rabbi sitting on this well, asking her for some water, and she feels in her heart how different she is than him. First of all, she's ethnically different than him. Her people and his people did not get along. Second of all, she's religiously different than him. Her people and his people, they hated each other's religion. And his people thought her religion was a cult. And we're going to find out in just a few minutes here that she was also, her sexual practices were dramatically different than his. And Jesus knows that, and she knows that. So he knows she's ethnically, religiously, and sexually like polarly opposite of him, but he wants to talk to her, and he very purposefully walks up to her and says, "Hey, can you help me out with something?" She responds as you would expect. "Well, you're going to ask me for something?" Look at how Jesus replies. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." So Jesus, he ignores the sarcasm. He ignores kind of the differences that are there. And he starts talking about what? He starts talking about living water. He starts talking about the gospel. We looked at this last week. In every situation, there's moments where Jesus could focus on people's sin, on people's issues. But Jesus doesn't make the issue people's sin. He makes the issue the gospel every single time. And he meets this woman who is his polar opposite, and he basically says, "Hey, if you just knew what God has for you, if you just knew the gift that God has for you, you'd be the one approaching me, even though we're so different." Now, she's annoyed with Jesus, so she's going to be purposefully obtuse here. "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw water or to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock?" She's challenging him a little bit here. She's saying, I think you're crazy. You don't even have a bucket, right? Jesus responds. Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." You know, there's so much that Jesus could address with this woman, isn't there? I mean, there's so much between them, and they just met, but what is he talking about? The gospel. He's making that the issue, and he's wearing her down. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go call your husband and come back." Now, there's some stuff going on here related to gender roles in first century Judea, but I want you to notice something. I don't have time to get into all of it, but I want you to see a lesson here. From a posture of love, from a posture of incredible kindness, from a posture where he's ignoring some of her sarcasm, he's put the gospel first, but he's not going to ignore issues of lifestyle. He's going to go there with her. And he even, in fact, brings up her sexuality. He even brings that issue up, and he's not going to offend her with it. He's not going to condemn her, but he's also not going to avoid the subject, and it makes her a little bit uncomfortable. Watch what happens. "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you've just said is quite true. So he's going there, and Jesus somehow had this divine knowledge about her. So she responds, "Sir, I can see that you are a prophet." It's an understatement. She's shocked. She's a little surprised. Watch what she does in her shock. "Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem." She's changing the subject. I love this moment. Jesus has made her so uncomfortable that she's like, hey, to avoid an awkward conversation about my sexuality with a stranger, how about a heated religious debate? Let's talk about that. This is like the one time religion is preferable to whatever the conversation is. So look at how Jesus interacts with this. "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and truth." Now, there's a lot here, and I don't want to unpack it all, but I want you to just notice and understand. There's this heated debate, a violent debate between two sides, and it was related to worship, and she basically says to Jesus, "Which side are you on?" And what does Jesus say? He says, "Both sides are missing something. I'm not on either side." And in just a few sentences, Jesus kind of rises above this incredibly polarized, loaded debate that was happening in his world. You know, to a lot of people, this was like the most frustrating thing about Jesus. You see this again and again in the Gospels. People come to him with a question and they're like, "Hey, it's either this or this. What do you think, Jesus?" And Jesus doesn't answer their question. Or they say, "It's this or this, which side are you on?" And Jesus says, "Well, I'm not on either side," and he rises above it again and again. This is not the main point of the sermon today, but I do think this might be helpful for us to realize. We live in an incredibly polarized culture. We live in a culture that has a lot of debates just like this, right? Where there's two sides, and we have this two-party system, and the weakness of that is every issue is reduced to it's either this or it's either that. I think we would be wise to imitate Christ in this way. When he was faced with those sorts of scenarios, somehow with wisdom and grace, he always would kind of rise above the two polarized arguments. Jesus faced this sort of thing all the time. And in most every case, he reframed the issue. Our culture, I think, says to us as Christians and says to us as the church a lot, "Hey, here are the two sides. Which one is it?" And I think foolishly as Christians, a lot of the time we say, "Well, okay, I guess I'll pick." Jesus never got bullied into taking sides in a heated, polarized debate in his culture. He always rised above it. And I think it would be wise for us to imitate Jesus in this way. Look at the effect it has on this woman. The woman said, "I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he'll explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, am he." Just then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. They knew this history too. But no one asked, "What do you want?" or "Why are you talking with her?" I love the disciples. They're oblivious, and you can almost hear the argument as they're walking up. "I'm not going to ask him. You ask him. Let's just not even ask him." And then look at her response. Leaving her water jar, because now she's a little uncomfortable. There's a lot of these men now. The woman went back to the town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?" He came out of the town and made their way towards him. Now, we'll skip down to verse 39. We hear the conclusion of the story. "Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did." So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days, and because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we've heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world." So again, in the story, we see Jesus, and he's in this moment where he could make the issue all manner of sins or disagreements, but it makes the issue the gospel, because that was his foundation. That's always what he did. But we also see this remarkable truth about Jesus. Jesus loved actual people. Jesus loved actual people. And in this case, what that meant for him is he was going to spend some time, a couple days, with the social pariahs of his day, and that's Samaritans. And I think the way he loved them really matters here, because I think we see something remarkable in the interactions that he has. I'm sure this is true. I'm sure in Jesus' day that there were a lot of people in his culture that would say things like, hey, I have nothing against Samaritans. I don't hate Samaritans. I mean, I love them. I pray for them. I pray that one day that they will embrace the true faith. I do. And I'm sure that somewhere in Jesus' day, if they had Facebook walls, they were probably actually walls where they wrote stuff, that people would post stuff on their Facebook walls, like 40 questions for people who advocate Samaritan worship. And hey, I just want to have a dialogue about it. I'm not trying to start a fight. I just have some genuine questions for you people who think Samaritan worship is okay. Now, I don't want to come down too hard on that sort of stuff because our culture is inundated with it, and I don't want to offend anyone. But I want us to notice there is a huge difference between what Jesus does and all of that stuff. There is a huge difference between the way Jesus engages with that issue and all of that other stuff. I think this is the difference. Jesus actually went there, right? This was not some theory. This was not some idea. Jesus actually was in Samaria. And when Jesus says, I love Samaritans, he's not talking about a people group. He's not talking about the idea of Samaritan people being loved. He's talking about Janet, or whatever her name is. I don't know. He's talking about actual people that he met, not a concept. He's talking about actual people that he interacted with, that he spent time with. And if you and I are going to set out to change the world, we can't skip over that. And we have to realize that not only was the gospel first in every situation for Jesus, but he also spent time loving actual people. That was the foundation of what he did. His love was never theoretical. He knew their name. He knew what they cared about. He knew what their hopes were. He knew what their fears were. And if we're going to change the world the way that he did, we have to have that same foundation. I think it means this, that no matter what, our love has to have a subject and a story. If you hear nothing else, maybe this is the thing to write down. If we're going to change the world, no matter what we do, our love must have a subject and a story. And here's what I mean by that. If we say, I love Muslims, or I love Republicans, or I love gay people, or I love orphans, if we say that and we aren't referring to a person with a name and a story about how we put them first in our lives, then that's not love. And that's okay, but we need to be honest about that. That's not love. Love must have a subject and a story. Jesus never tried to love the idea of something, because he was too busy loving actual people. He never seemed to love people groups. He never seemed to love issues. He always seemed to prefer loving actual people. And if we, as Christians, embrace this calling to change the world around us, but we skip over that idea, we skip over that foundation, we're going to do enormous damage to the world around us. Our love has to have a subject, and it has to have a story. And if it does, then, if that's our foundation, I think we're ready for the world hack, and I'm going to tell you about that next week, but we have to decide first, are we going to have the same foundation as Jesus? If we do, if we say, yeah, I want to love in this way that Jesus loved, I think it means a few things that are challenging for us, and the first one is this. We have to go to there. To where? To there. I don't know. Wherever there is, we have to go to there. Jesus, there was Samaria. So Jesus went to Samaria. We have to go to there. It's probably not Samaria for us. But I promise you, everyone in this room has a there. We have a place where we would not naturally be inclined to go, a place where there are actual people that actually need God's love. And we can't love them from here. We have to go to there. And that's what Jesus did. We need to realize in the story, there were lots of ways to get where Jesus was going besides cutting through Samaria. That's true. There was lots of roads. He could have gotten where he was going a number of ways, but he purposefully set out to put Samaritans in his life. Jesus wasn't there because he had to be. Jesus was there because he chose to put Samaritans in his life. I love what the great author Henry Blackaby says about this. He says, "You can't go with God and stay where you are." Maybe he meant that figuratively. I think literally it's true. You can't go with God and stay where you are. Jesus knew that. Jesus knew that love requires us to go to there. You know, for some of us, it could be to go across the street to a neighbor's house. For some of us, there might be that cubicle that we, kind of always walk to the water cooler the other way to avoid walking by. You know, for some of us there, it might be a country on the other side of the world. I don't know. But if we're going to change the world, we have to be willing to go to there. Our love can't be a theory. That's the first thing it means. Here's a second thing that I think it means. We need to love an actual Samaritan. I was thinking about this. I think the way God would have us apply this is just start with one actual Samaritan. I'm using a metaphor here. There was some debate in the first service. Are there actual Samaritans? Someone looked it up. There are actual Samaritans. So perhaps it's an actual Samaritan, but also a metaphorical Samaritan. I don't know who that is for you, but I bet you know who it is. We need to love an actual Samaritan. And I don't mean turn them into a project for Jesus. I mean actually love them. Actually learn to appreciate them. Actually begin to care about what they hope for. Begin to care about what they fear. Begin to care about their needs. Jesus met this woman and she was really rough around the edges. She was sarcastic and she was angry and she didn't want some pretentious Jewish rabbi interrupting her day asking for water. But Jesus loved her. He wasn't offended by any of that. He met her literally and emotionally right where she was. He didn't react to her. He didn't correct her anger. He didn't overwhelm her with all the flaws in her logic. And there was a bunch. He didn't make her feel less valuable because she had so many mistakes in her life. In fact, what he does, and this is the most amazing part, is he tells her something about himself that even his disciples don't really know at that point. She asks about the Messiah, and he says, "Yeah, that's me." And she's one of the first people to know that Jesus was the Messiah, the Savior of the world. He reveals himself to her, and what we see in this relationship is that it's an actual relationship. It's this actual two-sided relationship. He was getting to know her, and he was letting her know him. He was loving an actual Samaritan. It wasn't just a theory. It was a real relationship. And I think this is the challenge. If you and I, if we want to change the world, we've got to be aligned with this foundation Jesus had. And I think we've got to answer these two questions. Where is your Samaria? Who is your Samaritan? Where is your Samaria? You have to go to there. Who is your Samaritan? You have to love that person. This world won't change unless we answer those questions, if we don't have that same foundation. And it's remarkable. Jesus doesn't get sucked into some cultural war between God's people and those wicked Samaritans. He rises above that. He was too busy loving actual people, and I think he knew this, that love trumps opinion every time. So he was actually there in their city, loving them, and he made that the foundation of his ministry. If we're going to change the world, I know you're frustrated with it. I know you're frustrated with it. You see things, and it's just outrageous to you what's happening. If we're going to change the world, we have to start here. That's where Jesus started. Let me give you maybe one example of this, and then I'll close. You guys, many of you may know Lindsay and Ron Yoakum, who have been at our church for a number of years. Amazing family, do so much, contribute in so many ways to our church. They're a great family. I was talking with Lindsay about this, and she told me a story that I thought really captured what Jesus was doing here. About 3 years ago, Lindsay was picking up her two children from school, her son and her daughter, and she noticed as she was walking to pick them up that there were two other kids there playing with her kids, a little boy and a little girl about the same age as her boy and girl. Right away, she could kind of tell that they maybe came from a less than ideal home situation. They were a little rough around the edges. And as she walks up, they ask her, "Hey, can we come over to your house today?" Now, as a parent, I've been in situations like that. And if you're a parent, you understand. I mean, little red flags are going off. And, you know, it's one of those moments where you're torn because you want your kids genuinely to love everyone, right? But you also are like, I don't want you to love everyone. And you're worried about that. And so it's one of those moments. But Ron and Lindsay are the type of people who go to there. And so they, of course, welcome these kids into their home. And for the last 3 years, have been building a real relationship with this actual family, with these kids and their mom and the rest of the family. As they've gotten to know the family, Lindsay said, it is a family in perpetual crisis. And these kids, they have experienced every type of chaos in the home you could imagine, and I promise you some you could never imagine. Lindsay said, part of the problem is that this is a mom who has literally had every bad thing happen to her that could happen to a person. And as you can imagine, she said she's just never seen in her 31 years what a healthy and supportive family would even look like. And so that, of course, affects their whole family unit, or until the Yoakums came along, that is. At one point, they realized that this family of five was living in a two-bedroom apartment, and the oldest son, who was friends with Lindsay and Ron's son, was sleeping on the couch every night. That was his bed. So Lindsay and Ron went out and bought bunk beds and put them in their kids' rooms so that they could spend the night whenever they wanted to. And they told this family, hey, whenever you want to, your kids can spend the night with us and just bring them on by. And of course they have. Lindsay said, I just wanted them to have one safe place in the world where these kids could rest because they live with such chaos at home. And she realized that maybe that safe place was going to be in her kids' rooms. So right here in the suburbs of Colorado Springs, which doesn't, I mean, I live there, suburbs of Colorado Springs, it does not look or feel like Samaria. Lindsay and Ron were faced with a choice: to love actual Samaritans or to stay home and talk about the theory of love. And for the last 3 years, that's what they've been doing. Lindsay said it has felt like two steps forward and three steps back. And then she wrote this to me in an email. I thought this was so good. It's absolutely not all rainbows and cotton candy doing what Jesus asks us. That's your sermon right there, right? She said, Ron and I have had many arguments over what the right thing to do is, and in general, we have no clue what that is supposed to be. And she said this about the mom. Is she taking advantage of me knowing I'm willing to help? Well, the fact is, I don't know, and honestly, I don't care. I'm not Jesus. I can't see the inside of people's souls. I can only see the outside. And that view tells me to act. You know, it's one thing to say I care about families in crisis. It's one thing to say I care about struggling kids. Man, Jesus buys the bunk beds, right? That's the nature of his love. Jesus buys the bunk beds. You know, I know you're like me. You look at this world and there's so much that frustrates you. And you think, man, if there was just something that I could do, I would do it. This is what we can do. This sort of love. And if our foundation isn't the same as Jesus, if it's not gospel first, if it's not, hey, I'm going to actually love a messy Samaritan, the world isn't going to change. And I know you feel that. I know you want to change this place. Jesus buys the bunk beds every time. And the challenge for us is to adopt that same foundation. We're not Jesus, and so we're not going to get it right every time. But if this is going to change, that has to be our foundation. And then next week, I'll tell you what the world hack is. But for now, we've got to focus on the gospel first and loving actual people. Let me pray for us.